This is the podcast for Wednesday, February 9th, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. First, a few announcements. One is that the Students for Liberty Club, I guess about maybe a year old, maybe 2 years old, it's been in hiatus and to various degrees, but they're looking at getting started. There's a student doing co-op who's taken up the mantle for organization. So if you believe in the freedom of the individual, once you move out of the house, away from your parents, you don't want Uncle Sam being your new adopted parents, telling you what to do, how to lead your life. You think the government should stay out of your life, they should stay out of your pocketbook, that you have the freedom to buy, sell, trade, work with any arrangement you would like, that you want to be able to buy goods and services on a voluntary basis, not have someone stick a gun to your head and say, hey, we've got these great services to sell you, you know, pay up or else, and then you get crappy service, which is the sort of system you have with forced taxation, redistribution of wealth, and so on and so forth. And if you also want the government to stay out of your personal medical decisions, your personal habits, your choice of which substances you want to imbibe as an adult, and so on, then you might like this group. So the slogan is reason, freedom, and compassion. So if those are values that are important to you, there's going to be a meeting after a class at 4 o'clock next Wednesday in room 260 in Building 1. So Building 1, room 260 at 4 o'clock. From 4 probably till 5, free food, free pizza. So a group that believes in freedom, and you get free food. So, if you're interested in, you know, being part of the organizational team, sort of helping put together events, you have an idea for some kind of an event, or there's a documentary film or something you'd like to show, or a campus speaker you think would be really cool to have, come on down. So I'm just a faculty advisor, so I won't be yakking a lot. I'll kind of be sitting on the sidelines and making sure people don't violate campus policies, and just serve as a formality. So this isn't my deal. This is a student club. So, and it will take whatever direction the students choose for it. So I'll pass these around. I think I got like five here. If you're interested in coming, you can grab one of these, or you can write down the information, pass it down, or you're free to ignore it, which is part of what being this free society is all about. Let's see. We have other announcements. The other announcement is that the exam will open right after class today at 3:30. It will cover the chapter on empiricism, which is chapter 3 after Locke. So it will conclude chapter 3 from page 89 on, which means Berkeley and Hume. And we'll also cover chapter 4, which is on Kant. So the philosophers we'll be studying from page 89 on is Berkeley, Hume, and Kant. So empiricism and Kant, which is who's sort of his own deal. You call him the sort of Kant gives you again a synthesis between rationalism and empiricism. So it'll be empiricism after Locke and Kant. Now, you will need to know something about Locke's views, because in the two dialogues between Hylas and Philonous, Hylas represents the view of Locke, right? So in order to understand Berkeley, you really need to understand Locke. So you might get some questions about Hylas's views in the two dialogues. So if you missed some questions on Locke, or you were kind of confused on Locke on the first exam, you might want to look over the Locke material, or at least pay special attention to the two dialogues and to the commentary on Berkeley, so that you make sure you understand the distinction between the views of Hylas and Philonous, or between Locke and Berkeley. Also, make sure you know how to correctly pronounce the name Berkeley, because that will be on the exam. So the first syllable is like, you know, a barking dog. It's Berkeley. Even though because it's pronounced, you know, the name's pronounced Berkeley in the University of California school, That it's sort of like you get these anglicized versions of British names, but it's like, again, there's a place in England called Berkshire, and it's spelled Berkshire, but it's pronounced Berkshire. So, in the future, when we all speak Esperanto, ha ha ha, as they've been saying since the 70s, in the future, when we're all speaking Esperanto and using the metric system, then everything will be spelled phonetically. But in the meantime, it's Barclay, and it's spelled like Berkeley, but it's pronounced Barclay. And it's, Descartes. and I'm not sure why people think that Hume has an S on the end of it, but Hume is just Hume, H-U-M-E, David Hume, no S. And also I'd like to mention this. I sent a couple of private messages. I think on the forum post, I sent a couple of warning messages about this, but when you make your forum post, I expect you to begin sentences with a capital letter, and to use punctuation, including apostrophes, and to do some rudimentary proofreading of your post. And if you're doing this in a word processor, it ought to like give you little squiggly underlines in red of misspelled words as you type, or you ought to be able to do a spell check. I think there's even online spell checks too.
I thought you had said in the beginning of the class that you just kind of wanted us to start ranting on it, that it was okay just to start typing and to get it out there as freely as possible. Did I misunderstand then?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, my bad.
So I think what I was saying was, as far as the idea is expressed, I don't grade the posts per se. So it's not as if I go through and I'm ranking the posts. The posts are, you read the material, you've addressed the material in some fashion, and then you give me some analysis, original analysis of the material you're supposed to be dealing with. And whether you make a good point, whether you're totally off base and I come in and actually give you some feedback and correct you so you're not laboring under false impressions on the exam, or whether you make a sort of a mundane point that is sort of obvious, or whether you make a super insightful point which is really interesting, and there's been posts of all those sorts. And whether your post is like 100 words exactly, or whether it's 500 words, which I don't want, by the way, you get the point. But please, show respect for the English language and for your fellow students by not having a string of misspelled words, use complete sentences, And also, I'd appreciate it too if you're going to type more than 100 words, break it into a couple of paragraphs. And if you're using Microsoft Word or something, save it as plain text and then paste it in. Because I'd see these people, and people have been pretty good about it, but there's still been people that I see this, these Microsoft fonts in there, and it makes the text extra big. Or some people I see there's like, there's this much space at the end of their post that and they don't never look at it after they post it, apparently. You can click the edit button for 30 minutes after you make that post and make some changes. It doesn't go out right away. And so one thing you want to make sure is that you don't have like a whole computer screen worth of space, or half a computer screen worth of space on your post that everybody has to scroll through with their scroll wheel. Because that's just sort of a pain. And I've been going in and editing people's posts and fixing it, but it would be nice if I didn't have to do that. So just a helpful reminder, because other people have to put up with the scrolling too. So if everyone follows these rules, everything will turn out nicely. And again, even if you're, does anybody use their phone? Can you use your phone to post on the forum? I don't know if that Moodle is amenable to that or not. Anybody ever do that? Can you use the Moodle messaging? So you've used your phone to post, and it works? Cool. Well, I don't use your are you using like a web browser in your phone or something? Okay. So sometimes, usually on like the phone keyboard, it will automatically start your sentence with a capital letter, and it just sort of automatically does that. So even if you're typing your post with your thumbs, which you're welcome to do, put in those capital letters and apostrophes, even if you have to click over to that other alternate keyboard to make sure it's. I know increasingly things seem to degenerate. As people are more and more using these mobile devices, the rules of grammar and punctuation and spelling seem to go out the window. So, but it makes it a lot easier to read if I don't have to to wade through those mistakes. Okay, so let's see if there are any more questions about Kant, and then I'm just going to review from the beginning, going back to Berkeley, and review what's on the exam. Any last questions on Kant? Yes, Alicia.
Well, it's said a couple times, referenced a couple times in his writing, the principle of contradiction. I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Okay, and maybe I can look at can you get a page number so I can look at the context.
Sure, 153, in the middle of the page.
Okay. So he says that all bodies are extended is not an empirical judgment, but a proposition which stands firm a priori. So all bodies are extended, what does that mean? That means for something to be an object, that means it's extended in space. It takes up space, or it has some size. That's just what's meant by extension. Remember back in Descartes talks about extension as a property. It just means to be spread out in space. And so he says all bodies that are extended is a priori, because that's something which is known through reason. It's just the definition of what it means to be an extended thing, or to be a body. To be a body means to be extended in space or to have size. All objects have some size by definition. For before addressing myself to experience, I have in my conception all requisite conditions for the judgment, and I have only to extract the predicate from the conception according to the principle of contradiction, and thereby at the same time become conscious of the necessity of the judgment, a necessity which I could never learn from experience. Okay, so the question is, could you ever learn from experience that all bodies are extended? And the idea is, could I just like look at a couple of objects and we could say, is this a body? Well, yes it is. Is it extended? It appears to be. Okay, let's go on to the next object. Here's a body. Here's an object. Does it have some size? Is it extended in space? Yeah, okay. And you sort of, and then you form the general idea that, okay, all bodies are extended. In the same way, you might say, you know, do all birds have wings? Well, there's a bird. You know, does it have wings? Or you sort of go down the line, think about, and actually all birds have wings. That's probably not a good example. How about can all birds fly? That might be like something where you think about flight, you might think, well, you know, is that part of the definition of a bird, or is that just a fact about birds? And you might say, well, there's a crow and it can fly, and there's a blue jay and it can fly, and then sort of you're coming down, but then you see like a chicken, and you're like, well, a chicken seems to be a bird, but it can't fly. And so therefore, like empirically, you'd say, okay, well, not all birds can fly. Can you do that with bodies? Kant says no, because in order to recognize a body in the first place, you have to recognize it as a thing which is extended in space. And the principle of contradiction is you can't conceive of a body or an object that isn't extended. So Kant would say, if you say this object has no size, that's a contradiction, because part of what it is to be an object is to have size. It's like to say this triangle has four sides. Kant would say that's a contradiction, because to say something is a triangle is to say that it has three sides. That's an essential property, such that a thing can't be a triangle without having three sides. So the principle of the contradiction, he just says that you know all bodies are extended because it's a contradiction to say this is a body that's not extended. In the same way, it's a contradiction to say this bachelor is married. If you understand what a bachelor is, you understand that a bachelor is essentially unmarried. And if you say this bachelor is female, again, that's a contradiction, because part of the definition of bachelor is male. And that's not something you learn from experience, as if you could take a survey of all bachelors and find out whether they're male and whether they are married. Right? If you understand what a bachelor is, you understand the predicate is an unmarried male is true. And so to know whether a bachelor is an unmarried male is true, if you just look at the subject and you look at the predicate, and you can see that the predicate is sort of hidden inside the word bachelor, such that it always goes along with the word bachelor. Whereas, as is able to fly, isn't part of the definition of a bird. Although, maybe having wings is part of the definition of bird. That one's sort of, you know, how do you define a bird? You know, all birds have beaks. Sometimes you get kind of, you get these kind of borderline cases where it's hard to tell what's part of the definition of a thing as opposed to what's a fact about it. But you have these clear cases where you could say all bodies are extended. It is an example of, it's not an empirical judgment because the opposite implies a contradiction. So, and this actually goes back to Hume. Hume says the same thing. Hume says, how do you know whether something's a contradiction? Well, how do you know when something's a necessary truth? It's when its opposite implies a contradiction. So remember, Hume says, is there a necessary connection between cause and effect? And Hume says no, because its opposite doesn't imply a contradiction. To say if A happens, B must happen. If you can imagine the opposite happening, then there's no contradiction, right? There's no contradiction between imagining that I jump off a building and I can fly around, right? I can picture that in my mind, which shows that it's logically possible. Now, I might not expect it to happen, but there's no logical contradiction in being able to fly without visible means of support. Why? Because people tell stories about people flying and Superman and Lord Zod and think about other people that can fly, the greatest American hero and people flying around and flying carpets in the Arabian Nights, right? There's no contradiction involved there because you can imagine it. Where there is a contradiction in thinking about 2 and 2 is 5, that's a contradiction. Therefore, 2 and 2 is 4 is a necessary truth. That's another example of a contradiction. And keep on using the same examples here. Can someone else think about what would be an example of a necessary truth? Where you could imagine the opposite being true. How about all circles are round? I'm going to take another geometric example. Like, all these necessary truths are truths of mathematics or logic. And now the math is kind of an exception here in Kant. But it's say truths of reason or definitions of things. Kant says these are all known a priori. And you know them through reason, and you couldn't imagine the opposite being true. That's so the principle of contradiction is that if a thing is a necessary truth if you can't imagine its opposite. I should write this up on the board if I have to. Oh, here we go. Okay. Always laugh when I come into these slide carousels. Where's the embedded 8-track tape player? Okay, everyone, take out your ViewMasters and put in the correct cartridge. Actually, I have students that complain that they don't have that there aren't overhead projectors for their transparencies on all their classes. I'm thinking somebody is just a few years away from retirement. All right, let's see. So that is a necessary truth. No. A priori. So all bodies are extended, or again, half size. This is another way of thinking about this. So, So you think, okay, what if you say, you know, some bodies or this body has no size. And Kant would say this is a contradiction. Because the concept of a body and the concept of having no size and these two things, they don't go together.
That if you're thinking about a body, it has to have size.
It's sort of the same as this, you know, this bachelor is married or is female. This triangle has four sides. So that's what Kant means there. And it's kind of a long explanation. Does that make sense, the principle of contradiction? And then there's the principle of non-contradiction, which is that, you know, so the principle of contradiction is just that, his way of saying this is that if the opposite of something implies a contradiction, then that's something that has to be true. Sometimes people will talk about the principle of non-contradiction, which is just that two opposite things can't be true. That A and not A, or X and not X, can't be true at the same time, the same way. So if it's true that it's sunny outside, it can't also be true that it's rainy outside. If I qualify by outside, I might set out some, you know, within the campus grounds, you know, I might qualify what I mean by outside. If I say on campus, you know, and I say that means absolutely every square inch of campus, there's absolutely zero precipitation. Once I qualify what I mean by by terms, it can't both be raining and not raining at the same time on campus. And so that's the principle of non-contradiction. And so, you know, what's Kant's general point in this passage? He's trying to distinguish between a priori and a posteriori. He says, so all bodies are extended. It's a priori. It's known not through experience. You can never learn that from experience. You grasp that with your mind. The concept of an object is something which you grasp through pure reason. You don't learn that empirically. And actually, you need the concept of an object in order to learn anything. It's something you start out with. It's part of the structure of your mind that you think about the world in terms of objects extended in space which have properties. And Kant also says that's part of the phenomenal world. It's not part of the noumenal world, which is unknowable. It's part of the world that human beings experience. And so anyway, you have a priori beliefs, and then there's a posteriori beliefs, which are things which you you can imagine them different. You can imagine the opposite being true. So he says, on the other hand, though at first I do not include the predicate of weight in my conception of body in general, that conception still indicates an object of experience. Let's see. And this I do when I recognize by observation that all bodies are heavy. I can cognize beforehand by analysis the conception of body through characteristics of extension, you know, having some size, impenetrability, that's sort of being solid, shape, etc., all of which are cogitated. I love this translation. Any conceptualized is what it means in this conception. Maybe that's why they use cogitated, because in German you cogitate a conception, it sounds kind of weird, so or conceptualize a conception. But now I extend my knowledge and looking back on experience from which I had derived this conception of body, I find weight at all times connected with the above characteristics, and therefore I synthetically add to my conceptions, this is a predicate, and I say all bodies are heavy. Thus it is experience upon which rests the possibility of the synthesis of the predicate of weight and the conception of body, because both conceptions, although one is not contained in the other, still belongs to it, only contingently. So he wants to contrast all bodies are extended versus all bodies are heavy. And this, he wants to say, is, does it imply a contradiction? So this body is not heavy. Implies no contradiction. And so this is known a posteriori. It's learned through observation. It's not part of the concept of an object or a body. And he'd also say it's synthetic. The predicate heavy is not contained in the subject. Body. Again, or object. Whereas this one, all bodies are extended, or have size, being extended and being a body, you can say this is contained in the subject. And so this is analytic. And also a priori. No, for reason.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Are there any analytic a posterioris?
Good question. No. So Kant agrees with Hume that all empirical truths are known synthetically. So say that again. Ask the question again.
Are there any analytic things? Is there any
analytic a posteriori? No. So if it's an analytic statement, it's always known a priori. Now there are some a priori statements which are known synthetically, or which are synthetic. There's some synthetic truths which are a priori, but there are no analytic truths which are a priori, or a posteriori. Okay, let me. I want to make sure I don't misspeak. So you think about, again, the a priori and a posteriori. A priori and a posteriori. And then you have analytic and synthetic. Again, that chart on page 151. Analytic and synthetic going from the top, and a priori and a posteriori going down the side. And so analytic and a priori is logic and definitions of things. And then both Hume and Kant agree that there's nothing in here. There's a big, or you could put a zero in this last year or something. Right? That it's a null set, as they like to say in set theory. There's nothing which is analytic in a posteriori. And then here, under synthetic a posteriori truths, there's truths about the world, or you could just put matters of fact existence. There are a lot of, we call these particular facts about the world.
So in a sense, Descartes was right that without reason, you couldn't have anything that was analytic?
Well, I think Descartes was right in that any truth of reason is known a priori. Oh, no. Sorry. Kant would say that Descartes was right in thinking that there are no analytic a posteriori truths. But Kant would say he's wrong in thinking that mathematics is analytic. So the difference here, you have the synthetic a priori, again, which includes math, and then you get these, again, presuppositions of science, which are so important, like every event has a cause. So there's a lot in the synthetic a priori category. So for the test that you should remember, the synthetic a priori is the most important category of knowledge for Kant.
It's where all the heavy lifting is done when you're coming with your theory of the world and trying to figure out things. You need to start out with certain first principles. And those principles are
all bodies are heavy.
Sorry, not all bodies. All bodies are extended. The universe is uniform. Every event has a cause. Those are things that you start out with as first principles. And you need those to do science, to believe there's a material world, to believe we can have knowledge of that world. Without those, you end up with a view like Barclay's or Hume's, if you go whole hog empiricist. And so you need certain rationalist intuitions about the nature of the world, that there's an objective world, that sensations come from a material world, that that the objects are extended in space, that the universe is uniform, cause and effect, that you have a mind, all those basic assumptions are necessary. Those are things you can't learn through observation, though. You can never learn, says Kant, all bodies are extended. You can never learn that every event has a cause through observation. All observation, using your senses, a posteriori beliefs, all those things can tell you is that every event that I've observed so far seems to have had a certain kind of event which preceded it. And that whenever A has happened in the past, it's been followed by B. To be able to say that A causes B, to draw that necessary connection, requires the rationalist concept, the a priori concept, that there is a necessary connection between cause and effect. That apart from the observation that A has always preceded B, is this idea that A is causing B. That's not something you can observe. You can't observe the necessary connection between cause and effect. What would it be like? You think about, okay, you have these two billiard balls, right? And billiard ball one hits billiard ball two, and there's like a clacking noise. And then billiard ball two, moves off in some direction. So imagine, your day of view. Try to observe the human as kind of a jelly face, right? He's looking down. Trying to figure out where's the cause and effect. Is it, he's kind of listening, is it the clapping sound? Do I hear a necessary connection? No. Do I see a necessary connection? No. Can I feel, like if I put my hand in between the billiard balls, would I feel the necessary connection? No, all you see is shapes and colors and sounds. So where's the necessary connection? Hume says, it's right in there. There is no necessary connection out there in the world. It's like color. Right? Color isn't something out there in the world. Color is something that your mind creates when you see an object, but it's not really out there in the world, it's in your mind. And so Hume says, all your senses show you is A and B seem to happen together all the time, and then your mind comes up with this idea that of cause and effect, but it's unjustified. Kant says, you have to start out with assuming that that connection is there for a reason, and that every event has a cause, and that when one thing happens before another thing, that there's some linkage between those things in the real world, which we call cause and effect.
since you can't observe it through your senses, it must be a principle of reason. And so that's that, and Kant says that's, you know, what you have to start out with that as a presupposition, as a first principle, as a guiding principle, something which is, again, it's a priori, you don't learn it through experience, but you need it in order for other judgments you make based on the senses to even make sense, to even learn, to do science. You have to assume every event has a cause. Can't prove it through the senses, can't prove it a posteriori, therefore it has to be a priori. So, and Kant says, commonsensically, we know that every event has a cause. Can't prove it through the senses, therefore we must know it through reason. And where did Hume go wrong? Being an empiricist, that's where he went wrong. There's something wrong with empiricism in that it insists that you can only know things through the senses or through these sort of, Hume's relations of ideas. And he has this disconnect between, relations of ideas, those are all a priori. Matters of fact about the world, they're all a posteriori. Relations of ideas have to do with the way ideas are related to one another. They're all, how ideas agree or disagree. Matters of fact, they're all based on the senses. And Kant says there are certain matters of fact, which, synthetic judgments, which are also a priori. And again, every event has a cause. The universe is pretty much the same everywhere. Objects are extended in space. And so there are some things that you know intuitively, you might say, that you have to start out with for the world to make sense. So that's how Kant is a synthesis between rationalism and empiricism. He has these certain rationalist first principles, maybe analogous to Descartes, I think, therefore I am, these synthetic a priori judgments, which serve as the foundation for knowledge. Did I address your question, Isaac?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Let's see. So that's how... That's how Kant thinks you can do natural philosophy or physics or science is by embracing these first principles, these a priori presuppositions, he likes to call them, of metaphysics. As you start out with certain first principles, and then you can deduce everything else. Now, as far as Kant's final conclusions, it's sort of a mixed bag. On the one hand, Kant seems to say that we can never know the real world. And so in that respect, you might think about Kant as being a skeptic. For me, he has this concept of the noumena, which is different from the phenomena. So these are good, again, test questions, terms, noumena, the thing in itself. Phenomena, the thing is humanly experienced. The German says the thing as such. As such. So, the literal term. But what does it mean? It means the thing as human beings perceive it. So the thing in itself, which means in its essence, apart from the way human beings experience it, that's noumena. So there's the noumenal world composed of the real objects which cause all of our experiences. This is Locke's concept of substance. And then there's the phenomenal world, which is the world we all experience. And one way to think about Kant's view is that all of our experiences, like Locke's secondary qualities. So, as Kant says, all experience is like Locke's account of how we experience secondary qualities. So all experience is like Locke's account of how we experience secondary qualities.
So, like, you know, the color blue. So, we experience all objects as blue. Are the objects really blue? Locke says no. Is there really an object there? Yes. Why do we see it as blue? Because that real object out there is absorbing a bunch of wavelengths of light. And there's one that it doesn't absorb that it's reflecting into our eyes. And it's a particular wavelength. That wavelength of light, which is a form of, you know, electromagnetic radiation, is bouncing off of our retina. And we have color receptors in there. Those color receptors in there take that wavelength of light and translate it into a certain kind of sensation. Now, why that sensation? Well, it's you know, there's two answers, right? One's intelligent design, the other one's evolution. So either our eyes, you can say our eyes are designed to interpret that particular wavelength of light as blue, or you could say, you know, nature or evolution has led to our experiencing that sensation as, you know, our interpreting or translating that wavelength of light into that certain sensation. So the object out there in the world, the blue chair, say, isn't really blue, but our minds interpreting it as blue. That's Locke's view. So now Kant says it's not just the blueness of the chair, it's the shape of the chair. It's the idea of the chair as an object. It's the idea, even the solidity of the chair, right? The chair is made of mostly empty space and some particles which are vibrating and whirling around, or maybe it's, you know, strings of you know, strings vibrating in 11-dimensional hyperspace, you know, made up of quantum stuff, right? The stuff that quantum mechanics tells us about. You have quantum states of particles, and so whatever the, you know, the physical description is, it's different than the chair we experience. The real chair is totally different than how we imagine. And if you want to ask, well, can I really know what the real chair is? And Kant says, no, you can't. You can have some, you know, we have these models, like we talk about, say, for example, strings vibrating in the 11-dimensional hyperspace. You go, well, what is a string? You know, what do you mean by, you know, vibration? And then the physicists will say, well, here's a bunch of equations which describe what happens when we smash some atoms together in a cyclotron. And you think, well, what's an atom? Oh, they're sort of like these little balls, and you have some have mass and some don't, and you smash them together, and here are these results, you know, and it's just a bunch of data based on these experiments we perform. Go back to the old Newtonian model, where you're thinking about atoms being like these little balls. But, you know, there are no real, you know, billiard ball-like particles, tiny particles floating around out there. It's a model to help us understand the real world. It you know, describes, it's sort of like an analogy. But there's no, you shouldn't confuse the analogy with the real world. It's just a representation of the real world, and it's based on observations, but there's no way for us to step out of our skin and the way our minds conceptualize things to see the real chair. We can never know the real chair. But what we can know is there's something out there causing our sensation of the chair. So how do we define the chair? Well, we define the chair we experience. And so Kant recommends we have this kind of science of appearances. We know rationally that there's a difference between the chair we experience and the real chair. We also acknowledge that we can never know the real chair. We can never perceive the real chair. And the way it appears to us is in part a product of the way our minds work and the way our perceptions work. So what we want to do as, you know, scientists or as philosophers is, given all these things that we know rationally, we want to come up with a kind of a basis for science which acknowledges all these facts and then comes up with some sort of generalizations about our experience, and we're going to call that knowledge, the science of appearances. So we can know the appearances. We can know the appearances relate to the real world in a certain kind of way, and we can know the appearances have certain relationships between each other based on what's happening in the real world. But we can never know the real world in itself.
So we have the science of phenomena, essentially. And Kant says that's what knowledge is. It's understanding of the phenomenal world. And understanding the phenomenal world is produced by the noumenal world, or the real world. And that's good enough.
Now, what was that last part? Sorry.
Understanding, we have a science of the phenomenal world. So we have a science of the of phenomena, the way human beings experience the world. And then we recognize the science of phenomena, that the phenomena on which it's based is coming from a real world, a noumenal world. So maybe I should write these up here. So
you said that the phenomenal world is coming from the
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
The phenomenal world. Is produced by the new world.
Thank you.
So would that be a presupposition of science then to assume that world does in fact exist?
Right. So you look at like Hume, who says, well, we have all these sensations that we don't know where they come from, so we're left with this big question mark. And Kant says, that's irrational. You know that the sensation, that the impressions have to come from somewhere. That's the noumenal world. We know the phenomenal world comes from, the world we experience comes from the real world. We can never know what the real world is really like, but we can make some generalizations about the way the real world appears to us.
Were you saying Kant believes in that?
Yeah, this is Kant.
Okay, sorry.
So Kant says the phenomenal world comes from the noumenal world. The phenomenal world is produced by the noumenal world. We can never know the noumenal world, so let's just call the phenomenal world, the real world.
Reality.
Yeah. Essentially, we can have science is a systematic understanding of the phenomenal world. We can have. We have knowledge of the phenomenal world. Oops. And that's good enough. That was a mess. I'm trying to avoid erasing so I can do my screen captures for the online class for what they're worth. So Kant wants to put this up here. One last thing. Kant lowers the bar for knowledge. I'm not sure where this metaphor comes from. Is that a weightlifting metaphor? It's not the limbo,
high
right?
Jumping.
High jumping? Oh, there you go. That's what it is. I never thought about this before. This is one of those stupid things. You're like, what does that mean, this term I've been using all my life? It's like when my wife, who like could speak some Spanish, says, oh, Los Angeles, that means the angel. I never thought about that before. It's like, you speak Spanish, this is the first time you thought about this. So this lowering the bar, you think about, okay, here, we're trying to figure out what... How do we get to the real world? The real world is so distant and tough, and you see all the way back to Socrates, people are trying to clear that bar, right? They turn pole vault over the trying to get over the bar, right? And then except for they fall, they keep on falling miserably, failing miserably, because it's so high. So what do you do? Well, Kant says, here's what you do. So here's the noumenal world. And Kant says that if you think about where that bar is, it's like a 1,000 meters. And actually, maybe it's more like we're doing this. Let's say you have somebody who's going, you know, it can't make it very high at all. So to be realistic, it's sort of. So
if human beings are trying to, I want to get to the noumenal world. I want to pierce the veil of appearances and get to the reality and the truth about life, universe, and everything. And what happens? Fail miserably. So what you want to do is just take the bar and put it down here. And here's appearances. This is the phenomenal world. That's something you can really get over, right? And that you recognize that you're kind of cheating. So you say, well, here's what we can know. This is sort of based on this. And so it's not like we say that the appearances is a real world. We say the appearances is kind of what we can get at. And we recognize the appearances come from a world which is objective. And that's sort of, that's a something about the real world. We can know something about the real world, namely that it exists and it is responsible for our experience. But we can never know what it is apart from our human conceptions and perceptions. All we can know is sort of that it's there and sort of maybe some basic notions about that, there is a real cause and effect and that the world is independent of our perceptions. And again, Kant says that certain things, like according to Hume, if you close your eyes, the world disappears. because it's based on perception. And Kant just says that's crazy to think that, or when you go asleep, the world pops out of existence. And then when you wake up again, it comes into existence. That kind of thinking is that's what your senses tell you. That Kant says that's irrational. But the idea that the world isn't a creation of your mind, or that you even have a mind, those aren't things you can observe. Those are, they're part of the objective world. So that there is an objective world independent of your perceptions is a rationalist intuition, and it's one of part of the foundations of knowledge. And Kant says it's okay to assume that, even though you can't prove it with your senses. And so you're assuming there is a real world, you're assuming it's independent of your mind, you're assuming your perceptions put you in touch with that world, although indirectly. And now what you need to do as a scientist is make some sort of generalizations and connections between all the different kinds of perceptions that you have, and form a general theory based on your rationalist intuitions and then your empirical observations. And then you'll have what we call science and philosophy. And that's the best we can do. And that's what you should do as a philosopher. And that's the guidance that philosophy can give to science. So that's Kant in a nutshell. And so a lot of people have said that you look at Kant, and Kant shows that you can't really, empiricism and science really don't go together, that you need something like the Kantian view for science even to make sense. And that's why you read Berkeley and read Hume, and you think, this is kind of nutty. Why would anyone believe that? Well, if you're an empiricist, that's where empiricism leads you. That's why you need something which is a kind of a hybrid view between rationalism and empiricism, the Kantian view. To help you that accords with common sense. Questions, comments, disputations, agreement, disagreement. Okay, so I hope I've given you a sort of comprehensive big picture of Kant. Let's go back to Berkeley and do some review. So remember this: the exam covers page 89 on to be is to be perceived. So Berkeley is an idealist, is one first thing. Again, you kind of page through the book. Oh, here's a bold term, idealism. What does that mean? It means that only the mental exists, or that only, for Berkeley, only minds and ideas exist. Minds are mental substances. So some people ask the question, well, when Berkeley says to be is to be perceived, does that mean that God doesn't exist unless people are thinking about him, or that I don't exist unless someone's looking at me? No, because
minds are substances, according to Berkeley. Berkeley does believe in substances, but only mental substances, not material substances. So minds are real. Minds have independent existence. And God is a being that exists independently. And so his mind exists whether or not you perceive him or think about him or pray to him or what have you. So God has independent existence. You have independent existence as a thinking being. I think, therefore, I am. So minds are substances. They're real. They have independent existence. They don't depend on anything else for their existence. When Berkeley says to be is to be perceived, he means that anything else apart from a mind only has existence if it is being, if it is in some mind or being thought about it. And Berkeley uses this word perceived. So a chair only exists if it is being perceived by some mind. Or to put it in ordinary language, the chair only exists if someone's perceiving it, or if someone's looking at it, or if someone's thinking about it. Or to put it yet another way, what it means to say, you know, X exists is to say X exists as an idea in some mind, or X is being perceived by some mind. And again, another way of putting it, a thing is just a complex idea. A thing is just a complex idea. Remember Locke's concept of a complex idea made up of simple ideas. And in Locke's view, the complex idea represents the real object out there in the world. And Locke would say, well, you have the thing, like, pick a new thing, like the satchel, and it's got its qualities, being a black, having zippers, you know, having metal parts, being filled with junk, right? So those are all the properties, being heavy. And then you have, so you have the thing, the satchel, and then it's got its qualities, being black, being, you know, 18 inches across, being able to fit in an airport overhead bin, you know, compartment, etc. Those are its qualities. Thing and qualities out there in the world. And then in your mind, there's the complex idea of the satchel made up of the simple ideas, which represent the qualities. So the thing is black. That's a secondary quality. And in your mind, there's a simple idea of blackness, which represents the black quality. You take the collection of qualities out there in the world, they combine to form those are all simple ideas in your mind that form the complex idea of the object, the bag. Now, for Berkeley, there's no separate object out there in the world. There's just the satchel. The satchel is just a collection of ideas, right? So ideas are just a collection of qualities or a collection of ideas. There's no difference between an idea, which is in your mind, and a quality which is out there in the world. Qualities are ideas, is what Berkeley says. And so qualities are ideas, and so objects are just collections of ideas or collections of qualities, which is the same thing. So what is a cherry? A cherry is the red, round, sweet thing that, you know, tastes good and stains your clothing, whatever. When it dribbles down in your brand new "Don't Tread on Me" shirt. So that are the qualities of the cherry. So just Berkeley would define as the red, round, sweet thing, you know, that, you know, getting all the qualities of the cherry. There is no real cherry out there in the world that the idea of the cherry represents. There's just the Berkeley uses the term sensible thing, meaning all the qualities of the cherry combined to form your idea of the cherry. And that's all there is to it. Where do those ideas come from? They don't come from the material world. They're fed to you directly by God, so that you perceive the ideas, the idea of the cherry, which comes directly from God. And again, Berkeley's kind of iffy on whether everybody gets the same idea of the cherry, whether we're perceiving the same idea, or whether you get your individually tailored ideas. But the objects are just collections of qualities. Or, you know, to put it in Locke's language, objects are just complex ideas So part of Berkeley's view is, part of Berkeley's philosophical program is to attack the views of Locke, his attack on matter. So he wants to show that this concept of the material world, which is the cause of our sensations, is fraught with difficulties, is contradictory, leads to absurd conclusions. Like one of the conclusions it leads to is you can never, you can only see sounds, but you can't hear them. Right? So like if you think about a sound as a disturbance in air molecules, you know, how do you see like that? You can kind of see a vibration, or maybe you can feel a vibration, or you could see a disturbance, but can you really hear a disturbance? No, what you hear is sounds. And Locke wants to say, well, a sound is just a sort of vibration of air molecules. Well, can you hear a vibration? Well, strictly speaking, you can't. You can hear a sound, but you can't hear a vibration or a disturbance of air molecules. The idea that Locke has is there's this disturbance of air molecules which causes little bones in your ear to vibrate, which somehow gets translated into your conscious experience of the sound. And what Berkeley says is that, no, there's just a sound which comes directly from God. So you're experiencing the sensible thing, the sound. And this whole thing about vibrations and so on is unprovable. So part of Berkeley's view is this attack on the material world, the concept of a material world, independent of your senses and independent of God. So your mind gets fed its ideas directly from God. From the dialogue, Hylas says, "You were represented in last night's conversation." This is sort of gossip about some party the other night. Hylas says, "You were represented in last night's conversation as one who maintained the most extravagant opinion that ever entered into the mind of man. To wit, that there is no such thing as material substance in the world." And Philonous says, "That's right." And if you can convince me that I should believe in material substance, give me some evidence for it, then I'll believe in it. But it's up to you to prove that there is such a thing. And for the exam, you're going to have to remember, some basic things like Hylas represents the views of Locke, Philonous represents Berkeley. But when Philonous attacks Hylas, that's Berkeley attacking Locke. And so a lot of this is this dispute about what you mean by a sensible thing. And part of the problem is that Locke has this sort of confusion between the real thing out there in the world and the direct sensation you have. And he tends to conflate the two. On the one hand, Locke wants to say you see the table, but then he says, well, I guess you don't really see the table, and you can never see the real table. You really see the idea in your mind that represents the table. And then Berkeley tries to shoot holes in that position. You can see Berkeley is kind of a forerunner of Kant, who finally says that you should, I give up knowing the real table. We can never know the real table. Locke wants to hold on to the idea that you can know the real table, that the table out there in the world is somehow represented by the table in your mind. And what Berkeley's doing is trying to shoot holes in that position. And then you should know some of the particular arguments, like substance is that which supports qualities, and then the idea is if you think about that literally, the substance is holding up the qualities. What does it mean for one thing to support another? It means to be underneath it and to be sort of spread out under it, holding it up. Well, to be spread out, that's a quality, right? That's the quality of extension, of having size. So if substance is spread out underneath qualities, and in order to be spread out, it has to have the quality of size or extension, then that quality needs to be supported by a second substance. That second substance, to support that quality, also has to be spread out under it. To be spread out under it means to have the quality of size or extension. So that quality is going to need another substance to support it, on and on and on to infinity. and you never sort of get to the bottom. And that's an absurd consequence of substance is that which supports qualities. So Berkeley says, you know, if you end up with that absurd consequence, then from your view, it shows there's something wrong with your view. It's contradictory. Again, this idea, going back to Socrates, the way to refute an idea is to show there's some internal contradiction or absurdity involved in maintaining the view. I think there was another couple of particular arguments here. Let's see. Oh, secondary quality. So here's a good question, possible test question. So what would Locke think of, what would Berkeley think about Locke's distinction between primary and secondary qualities? And based on the dialogue, what would Berkeley say about Locke's distinction between primary and secondary qualities? Would he agree with it completely? Would he go along with it, maybe with certain reservations? Would he, or would he reject it completely? Yeah.
I'd say that it's inconsequential because either way you look at it, it's just an idea of the thing anyway.
Okay, inconsequential. You mean like irrelevant?
Yeah. Any way you look at it, whether it's the primary quality of it or the secondary quality, it's still just the idea that God's putting in your head anyway.
Okay, so what does that mean? Like, what is the difference between primary and secondary qualities?
The primary is objective, and then the secondary would be what we perceive.
Right. So it's sort of subjective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the difference between primary and secondary qualities and the noumenal world and the phenomenal world? Are they kind of the same comparison?
So, for Kant, both primary and secondary qualities are part of the phenomenal world. Because Kant says your concept of shape and size is as subjective as your concept of color, and your perception of color. So if you're talking about Kant's point of view, it's all secondary qualities, because we can never get to the real world. Now, in Locke's point of view, the real world is made up of shape and size and density, and when you're perceiving those things, you're perceiving the action, you know, you're perceiving the real world. But then there's things like colors and smells and taste, which aren't part of the real world. They're the way we perceive it. So one way of looking at Kant is Kant says all of our experience is like Locke's description of secondary qualities. So I think I have both there.
So what would Berkeley think about Locke's secondary quality?
Berkeley,
that's what I'm saying.
That'll be on the exam.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't agree with it, would
you? Yeah, so primary, and so a primary quality is a real quality, right? A quality which actually exists in the world. A secondary quality is a quality which in part is created by human beings. So would he agree with it a little bit? Completely or not at all? Primary and secondary. Is there a distinction between a primary quality and a secondary quality?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he would completely reject it, right? Because what's the difference between a shape and a color? You see this in the dialogue over and over again, where Hylas says, well, there is the shape and the size, and those are real, and then there's the color and the smell and the taste, and those aren't real. But they're the way the real qualities affect us. And then Philona says, well, let me ask you a question. When you see, does shape and color, do they exist in the same place or different places? Like if I'm looking at this red ball, is the shape of the ball and the color of the ball, do they exist in the same place or different places? And Hylas says, well, they exist in the same place. And so Philona says, okay, well, either they're both in your mind or they're both out there in the world. Which is it? You know, you want to take the shape and put it out there, and take the color and put it in here. And that's contradictory, because when you experience the red ball, you can't see a color without a shape, and you can't see a shape without a color. And so that, so therefore, it's more consistent to believe that they're both in your mind as ideas put in there by God. And so he would completely reject the concept of primary and secondary qualities. It's all, as you said, it's all experiences produced in our mind, or given to our mind by God, produced by God and put into our minds. And so there's no distinction between the real out there world and what's in here, because there is no real out there world. It's all in here. It's all these ideas which are being fed to us by God. And, I think that's it on Berkeley. Again, Hume, think about Hume as being Berkeley without God, without mental substances, which is kind of a substance at all, and without cause and effect. You know, Berkeley has a kind of cause and effect, which he calls willing. You know, you have a will, and there's a kind of cause and effect in that when you have certain intentions and do certain things, God sends you certain kinds of ideas. When you brush your teeth every night, God sends you the sensation of, you know, having clean white teeth. If you don't brush your teeth every night, God sends you the impressions of tooth decay and, you know, root canals, or whatever, or the need for a root canal, infected nerves, right? But it's still all sensations being fed to you. So cause and effect for Berkeley is just that when you do certain things, God sends you certain sensations as a result. You know, someone like Locke would say, well, that's the laws of nature of the material world. For Berkeley, it's this idea that you can do things, you can have intentions and make decisions, at which results in God send you one set of ideas or sensations rather than another set. But so that's a kind of a cause and effect. Whereas Hume says there's no cause and effect at all. No minds, no God, no cause and effect, only ideas and the relation of ideas for Hume. And that's all we can know. And that's all we have time for. So good luck on the exam. And any questions, feel free to send me a little message or post a question on the forum. I'll open up another topic for questions on the second midterm. And we start on belief and will on Monday.